And gentlemen, my name is Nicholas Matassian, and I'm the president of the Friends of the McGill Library. On behalf of the Friends, I welcome you to the 2011 Hugh McLennan Memorial Lecture featuring Governor General Award winner Kate Pullinger. We're privileged tonight. The Friends of the Library began in 1988 as a group of individuals with a deep commitment to the McGill Library. Our board is a reflection of the people we serve. It includes community members, alumni, faculty, staff, and students. Our objectives are to enrich the library's role on campus and to increase the community's awareness of the library, of its role, its facilities, and its evolution. Since I became involved with the McGill Library just over 2 years ago, I've witnessed the tremendous impact that the library has on teaching, learning, and research at McGill. McGill University itself is a truly unique meeting ground for students and faculty from around the world, and much of that meeting occurs within the library. The library and its 12 branches received over 5 million real visits in the last year, and rightfully so. The library is a living and dynamic force. It is what propels much of the university's activities. If you have not visited our library recently, I strongly urge you to do so. It's quite a unique experience. But I will let our new dean tell you a lot more about it in a few minutes. Events like the Hugh McLennan Library, McLennan Lecture that we're having today, help the library to create a strong presence in the community and build awareness of the role that the university's libraries play in the life and outreach of McGill. Each year, the Friends of the Library sponsor this lecture and the Shakespeare and the F.R. Scott lectures. As you might imagine, donor generosity is extremely important to the library. I know that many of you here this evening support the library, and we thank you for that. For those of you who haven't, or those of you who wish to help the Friends of the Library directly, please consider becoming a member of the Friends of the Library, or give someone you know a membership as a friend. As the library needs us, we need you. And now, on behalf of the Friends of the Library, I would like to welcome Dr. Colleen Cook, our new Trenum Dean of Libraries, who officially took her post up at McGill on January the 4th. We are delighted that you are here with us, and I would like to call upon you to say a few words about the library.
Thank you, Nicholas. I very much appreciate it. Good evening. Before we begin this evening's program, I would like to say a few words about the McGill Library and my experiences as Trammell Dean of Libraries thus far. It's not just been about snow, and it's not just a soundbite when I say that I really do have the best job on campus. I truly think that research librarians have very special jobs right now, and we really do enjoy our jobs, and the really good thing is that everyone is ours, whether you're a lawyer, whether you're a professor, whether you're a student, whether you're an undergraduate first year, whether you're a postdoc. We get to represent all of you. All of you, we get to know all of you. We get to serve all of you, and it just makes the library a very special place, and my job a very special job. This is a huge and busy time in the life of the McGill Library at our 12 branches. Most of our libraries are open up to 84 hours a week, and during peak periods, such as right now, when it's crunch time for the students, we offer a 24/7 study area that's filled to capacity at all hours of the day and night. To keep up with our users' needs, our services are continually being enhanced. We have made significant additions to the collections in both physical and electronic forms, and we now have over 6 million items. We're very proud of the fact that for the second year in a row, the Globe and Mail has awarded the McGill Library top marks in Canada. We could not have accomplished these many things without the support of many of you, and very specially to our friends. Our services and collections are not just for current students and faculty. The McGill Library is committed to the principles of lifelong education and offers services and activities that are free of charge to alumni, parents, and members of the community. I encourage you to visit our libraries and ask questions when you visit. Drop in and read a book, access some of our e-resources, or chat live with our librarian 7 days a week. For this evening's event, the Hugh McLennan Memorial Lecture was founded in 1992 to honor the memory and outstanding literary contributions of John Hugh McLennan, internationally acclaimed Canadian author and five-time winner of the Governor General's Award for Fiction. His most famous work, Two Solitudes, published in 1945, was a bestseller in both Canada and the United States, and in 1946 won him the first of his five Governor General's Awards. In 1951, Hugh McLennan moved to Montreal and joined McGill University's Department of English, where he continued to write and publish. Montreal remained his home until he died on November 7, 1990. How fortunate we were to have had him here at McGill. And we're very fortunate tonight to have another Governor General Award winner, Kate Pullinger. Kate, the historical exploration and the innovative work you're doing with digital fiction and new technologies mirrors what we are experiencing here at the library. The impact of the digital world on the library has been huge. Libraries are no longer intrinsically tied to the physical world, and so much of what we do is about convenience, and a lot of that convenience is electronic, getting users the information they need, when they need it, from wherever they are in the world, and however and whatever they may need. At the same time, there are these wonderful physical objects called books that remain so important to all of us. There is something very human about being able to hold a book, turn the pages, and do so in the company of others in libraries, in the very special settings that are libraries. The library preserves and innovates, and we will continue to explore the possibilities with the help of everyone here. I would now like to call upon Professor Paul Yacknin, Chair of the Department of English, to introduce our very special keynote speaker. Thank you, and have a good evening.
Thank you very much, Colleen. I am an avid user of the library whenever I get a chance to leave my office in the Arts Building. Our McLennan Memorial Lecture for 2011 is one of a small but distinguished company that includes, among others, Rufus Wainwright and Christopher Plummer. She is one of a small group of McGill dropouts who have gone on to great success and eminence in the world of art. Kate Pullinger has written six novels, including A Little Stranger, Weird Sister, The Last Time I Saw Jane, Where Does the Kissing End, and When the Monster Dies. Her most recent novel, The Mistress of Nothing, won the Governor General's Literary Award for Fiction in 2009. It is a remarkable bringing to life of a meticulously researched account of Sally Naldret, a real-life lady's maid in Victorian England. Her mistress, Lady Lucy Duff Gordon, and her husband, not Lady Gordon's husband, but Sally's husband, Omar Abu Halawa. It is written in a prose that is direct and radiant with narrative energy, at once as Saharan and as fecund as the Egypt in which most of the story unfolds. In addition to this and her other distinguished novels, she has written two collections of short stories, My Life as a Girl in a Men's Prison and Tiny Lies. As you know, she co-wrote the novel of the film The Piano with the film's director, Jane Campion. She is a consummate artist in traditional literary forms and formats, but Kate Pullinger is also an artist on and of the web, and it is particularly fitting that and timely that she's the McClellan Memorial Lecturer this year, because McGill is pushing forward to integrate digital humanities into the traditional humanistic study that is one of the hallmarks of the university. One of a number of digital projects is the beautiful and enchanting Inanimate Alice. Check it out. An online interactive narrative designed to unfold endlessly within the imaginations of young readers. Kate Pullinger started in Cranbrook, British Columbia. She now lives in London, England. It is a very good thing that she has traveled back to her brief alma mater to speak to us about the future of fiction, historical to digital. Please welcome Kate Pullinger.
Well, thank you for the lovely introduction. That's great, and it's extremely very, very nice to be here. Very strange to be here at the same time. And I was so pleased when I got the email from Stephen Spodek inviting me to come to give this lecture because of my rather, you know, complicated history with McGill. So it was a big, really big thrill to be invited to do this lecture. So thank you very much for the invitation. And also I do think that it's a very exciting time for libraries, also for readers and writers. And, you know, the digital age brings us many, many challenges, but I also think it brings many, many opportunities, both in terms of access to information, but also in potential for new forms of storytelling and new forms of creativity. So tonight I'm going to talk a bit about a variety of things, and I'm going to end up with showing you a few little clips from one of the digital projects I'm involved with. So the title of my lecture is The Future of Fiction from Historical to Digital. And I knew, ordinarily when I do give lectures these days, I have bullet points, I make notes, and I know what I'm going to talk about, but because I knew I'd be nervous today because I'm here at McGill. And, you know, I still do have dreams about having to sit exams that I'm not prepared for. That's still a nightmare for me. You know, anyway, I knew I'd be nervous, so I've written it down, so bear with me. the title of this lecture is, in fact, derived from a lecture given by Hugh McLennan in 1959. To mark the Golden Jubilee of the University of Saskatchewan. And his lecture was called The Future of the Novel as an Art Form. But I'm going to begin by talking a bit about the past. I've been writing stories for a long time. I first started writing stories really when I first learned how to write. And I've been publishing short stories and novels since the late 1980s. And just as it is a literary prize that has been redefining my life currently over the last 18 months, it was a literary prize that enabled me to get started in publishing in the first place when in 1986, one of my short stories won a magazine short story competition in London, where I was already living by then. And that prize brought my stories to the attention of an editor who worked in a publishing house, who wrote to me and asked me if I would be interested in publishing a collection of short stories. That would never happen in 2011. Publishing is a very different world now. But that letter arrived on Christmas Eve. So I think that it is a cliche that in the life of a writer, nothing can really beat that first contract for the first book. And like many cliches, that's true. However, the Governor General's Award and being invited to come and do this lecture have been extremely exciting as well. But I wanted to start by talking about failure, because failure is always so much more interesting than success. I grew up in British Columbia. We lived, as was mentioned, we lived in a small, snowy town in the Rocky Mountains called Cranbrook until I was 10. And then we moved to the rainy west coast, to Vancouver Island, and a semi-rural suburban community on the sea outside Victoria. I was the last child of parents who were in their 40s when I was born. My siblings were all between 10 and 16 years older than me and had all left home by the time I was 7. So I had one of those happy, bookish, solitary childhoods and began writing when I was young. Writing was the only thing that ever really interested me, both academically and creatively. But like many teenagers, I felt I was living at the wrong life, at the wrong time, in the wrong place. My cultural life when I was a teenager consisted of watching Saturday Night Live on television and reading and rereading Scott Fitzgerald's novel, The Great Gatsby. Music was my other primary interest. I didn't find out about punk until it was already over, but the Sex Pistols and The Clash and Magazine and Joy Division and their godfather, David Bowie, sustained me. I consumed months-old copies of the NME, and it was this passion for British music that led me to conceive of the idea that the place I really belonged was London, England. I must note that I'm glad I'm here for the royal wedding instead of there, but anyway. Although you're making as much a fuss about it as they are. So when I was 16, I wrote a novella about a girl who runs away from small town on Vancouver Island to live in London, to go to music concerts and become a writer. But when I was 17, I finished high school and I was accepted here at McGill on a generous scholarship. If London was 6,000 miles from Victoria, I thought Montreal was nearly halfway. I had very great expectations of university life. And to me now, it seems remarkable that I did come here and I was only 17. To me, it seems terribly young. No wonder I got in a fix. I had great expectations of what university would be like because, like many people my age, I had watched *Brideshead Revisited* on TV. So that's what I thought, you know, it would be like. However, and this might annoy the McGill people in the audience, what I found both disappointed and challenged me. In 1979, which is when I came, McGill was an Anglophone university in a Francophone city, and the 1970s had not been a happy time here. And the professors that I came across in my classes, I started in the English department, were often ancient and detached, and much of the teaching seemed to me to be done by inexperienced teaching assistants. The English department seemed to offer nothing of interest to me. There was no sign of Hugh McLennan, for instance. One of my professors conducted his seminars with his cowboy boots up on his desk, surrounded by copies of fishing and hunting magazines. He liked to go on about how Hemingway was a real man, while Scott Fitzgerald was not. This offended me mightily. So I transferred to the philosophy department, but was soon out of my depth. I read Kierkegaard aloud to my friend Sarah, but that didn't mean we understood it, of course. In my small high school off the Machosen Road outside Victoria, I was one of the brightest kids in class, but there weren't very many of us. And at McGill, I was yet another monolingual cretin from the unformed West. So I began to pursue non-academic interests, including alcohol, drugs, and parties. They didn't have a department for that, sadly. So at the end of the first year, I lost my prestigious scholarship, and halfway through the second year, I dropped out completely. So, however, during my non-illustrious stint at McGill, I did take two classes that had a profound effect on my subsequent writing life. I studied Latin for one semester, having never studied it before, and this both fueled and supported my love of words and language. And I took a course on Canadian literature. In this course, I read Hugh McLennan, Mordecai Richler, Robertson Davies, Mavis Gallant, and Leonard Cohen, all writers who had felt it necessary to live outside of Canada during critical periods of their writing lives for both economic and cultural reasons. A younger generation of writers, including Margaret Atwood and Alice Munro, were busy proving this was no longer true, and the world of Canadian literature is now such a well-established international powerhouse that it seems extraordinary to think that in the past, for a writer to succeed in Canada, they first had to succeed elsewhere. And indeed, often when I do readings in the UK, one of the questions I'm frequently asked is, why does Canada have so many good writers? So the idea that a writer needed to abandon the country in order to find their true voice confirmed my own conviction that it would do me good to leave. In a way, Montreal was my first step away from the Canada I'd grown up in. While my experience of university didn't live up to my expectations, or perhaps, and I'll admit it's taken me nearly 30 years to figure this one out, I didn't live up to the university's expectations of me. Montreal itself did, absolutely. As you know, Montreal has a very distinct and original character as a city. It's got this shabby chic thing down pat with a kind of nonchalant glamour and complexity. The most interesting cities in the world are cities with secrets, and Montreal has plenty of secrets, I feel. Coming here was the first step toward making life difficult for myself, which is something I've always done, something that I've concluded is where my energy for writing comes from. I'm only happy, and I'm talking about creative happiness, not personal happiness, though they're often one and the same, if I'm slightly the wrong person in slightly the wrong place at slightly the wrong time, a moment too early, or indeed a moment too late. In fact, you could argue that that's the very thing that's become the sort of primary subject of my writing life, as well as my main modus operandi. I'm going to read just a short extract from one of my first published short stories, which is a story I wrote in my early 20s, which is called, of course, In Montreal. In Montreal, Christine was foreign for the first time. She'd never been outside the enormous and empty western province in which she'd grown up. In fact, she'd hardly been away from the small town where her family lived. To Christine, Montreal seemed as romantic and distant as Paris. Ever since she was a small girl and had seen Quebec on the television, watched those politicians with their gravelly voices and thick accents, she'd wanted to go and live there. So when she was 17, she packed her bags, and with the money she'd made car hopping in the summer at the drive-in restaurant, she boarded an airplane and began her adult life. In Montreal, Christine could not speak the language. When she arrived in the terminal and asked for directions to the city in her high school French, she knew immediately that she was out of her depth. The woman in the information desk replied to her in English, but that did not stop Christine. She was brave, determined, and stubborn, as only 17-year-old girls can be. Christine knew exactly what she was going to do with her new life in Montreal. She told her parents she was going to get a job. Notice there's no mention of university there. She told her parents she was going to get a job, save some money, and then go to university. But she had no intention of doing anything as mundane as that. Christine was going to speak French, dress in black, smoke Galois, live by herself, and best of all, become a lapsed Catholic. Within a week of her arrival, Christine had a job wiping tables and clearing dishes in a cafe in the bottom of Les Terrasses, a shopping complex on St. Catherine Street in downtown Montreal. It was one of those totally plastic little places that Montreal Enterprise is so bad at, a sub-American kind of dive, decorated in orange and lime green with mushroom-like tables sprouting out of the concrete floor and dingy mirrors on the walls. Along with the job, which paid much less than the legal minimum wage, a fact she didn't have enough French to complain about, Christine found somewhere to live. From an advert in the window of a small corner tabac, she rented a one-room apartment at the top of four flights of stairs down by the river in East Montreal, and so on. The other thing this story mentions is Montreal was all hers as well. Christine felt this as she strolled along the city streets. the churches, the parks, the cafes, the bar restaurants that stayed open all night, even the taverns on the corners that still did not allow women through their doors. In those first months, she often felt like embracing it all, but Montreal was much slower to accept Christine. Do you still have those taverns?
No.
So that's just a little bit from one of the first stories I wrote. Well, more like one of the first stories I published. And now I'm just going to read you again a very short extract from The Mistress of Nothing. It's another arrival, this time for the main character of the novel, Sally Naldret, the lady's maid, the story is from her, in her voice, from her point of view. So I'll just read a little bit from that. The bump when the ship nudged the dock gave me a quick shock, a spark of life. At last, Egypt. I turned to my mistress, who was standing beside me at the rail, looking out at the city smeary with smoke and heat, and said, "We're here." She smiled. "They say that Alexandria isn't really Egypt at all." "No, my lady," I said, and though I knew this already, I still felt disappointed. "An in-between place, Mediterranean, African, and European, full of phantoms that have long since disappeared." I looked at my lady, unsure of what she was saying, the tone of her voice harsher than I was expecting. On the journey, she had seemed as excited to be traveling to a place of such antiquity. I was reminded once more of all she had left behind. No doubt, arriving at our destination had reminded her as well. "But you are right, Sally," she said, turning towards me and laying her hands on mine as though to reassure me. "We're here, Egypt." Our first journey through the city horrified us both. Nothing we'd seen in the Cape last year had prepared us for this. Filth. Wretched little children begging for money every time the carriage came close to stopping, which was frequently giving the terrible congestion in the narrow streets. One child came too close as the carriage moved forward. I saw a man pull him back off the road to the safety of a doorway where he began to beat him with a slipper he'd removed from his foot for that very purpose. The language ran past our ears, slippery, unmanageable, full of unfamiliar shapes and growls and wheezes. "I'll never learn a single word," I said. And as the carriage jerked forward yet again, I saw my lady go pale as though the precious health she'd regained during our sea voyage had flown out the window up into the hard, blue-white sky. Alexandria, as Mrs. Ross had warned us, was moldering, the sea air giving the city's buildings a salty frosting. I made my way through the streets lined with grand white European facades, glimpsing the Egyptian interiors of orange and red and gold and green. On my own, I made forays into the street markets and shops, but was too often defeated, returning home empty-handed with a great crowd of unruly children following behind me. In the streets, people smiled when they saw me, and I was unable to tell whether they were greeting me or laughing at me. I'd never been anywhere as truly foreign as this place. So the two extracts, really, are two people, both out of time and out of step and out of place. And when I was writing this essay and was thinking about what to talk about, I was quite startled to find this sort of marked symmetry between that story that I wrote more than 20 years and my most recent novel, these two characters both happily sending themselves into exile, which is, of course, what I have done myself. Thankfully, I can attest that the more recent writing is better, a little smoother, a little more sure of itself. But what both extracts also remind me of is my complete inability to learn another language. French in the case of my time in Quebec, and during the writing of The Mistress of Nothing, I spent 6 months having one-to-one Arabic lessons with an Egyptian, and I think I could probably come up with four words if I was had to sit an exam on the subject. So in his lecture, The Future of the Novel as an Art Form, Hugh MacLennan deconstructs the notion of literary criticism by saying all opinion is subjective. In talking about the novel, I'm like any other writer. I cannot be superior to my own tastes, experience, and problems. He goes on to discuss what makes the novel distinct among art forms. He says the novel is a communication in story form, and that its chief value lies in its capacity to entertain and in its characters. He says that a good novel consists of a continuing rain of accurate detail, which I think is a fabulous, fabulous phrase, and that the novel's subtlety comes from a combination of this rain of detail and the novel's roominess, in other words, the novel's length. He says, a satisfying novel must also hold all of its characters, all of its descriptions, dialogues, ideas, arguments, scenes, and actions within a whole which is harmonious, within a whole where the surprises are seen in retrospect to have been inevitable. And in the supremely satisfying novels, as in all good works of art, there is finally a mystery. And as I said earlier, the most interesting cities are the cities with secrets, enigmas, and mysteries, and the most interesting novels are the novels with enigma and mystery. But, McLennan continues, now I must change the key. The novel, which has bestrode the literary field for more than a century, which has ruled almost without a rival, is now in jeopardy. So, to the writers and publishers and booksellers in the audience tonight, McLennan's words, spoken in 1959, sound rather familiar. The novel's in jeopardy. The book is in jeopardy. At least we hear this said often enough that it must be true. For McLennan in 1959, the threats to the continuing viability of the novel as an art form were as follows. The rise of the cheap mass market paperback on the one hand, but more importantly for McLennan, the rise of nonfiction. He says, biographies of real people used to be as dull as obituaries. Now they're fascinating. Accounts of historical and current events used to be handled in the prose of scholars and reporters. Now they're all handled with consummate art and a wealth of artifice. He continues, for all I know, this really is the age of nonfiction. McLennan cites Rachel Carson's The Sea Around Us and says the real reason it and other works of nonfiction like it have become bestsellers is that they're entertaining. McLennan then goes on to cite what he sees as another enemy of the modern novel, which, of course, in 1959 was television. However, interestingly, McLennan did not feel that television posed a serious threat to reading because, in his view, television content was too beholden to commercial sponsors, and thus, as he says, most of its fare is and must be kept free and harmless. It cannot permit too much truth to come out in its plays and stories. In other words, the risk of offending the sponsors are too great for television to be allowed to broadcast real stories, the types of stories that are the territory of the novelist, stories full of the continuing rain of detail, stories remarkable for their truth. So for McLennan, television posed no serious threat to his art form. For him, the only real threat is the claim that it makes on our time. So if we scoot forward 50 years to 2011, we look at the popular cultural forms that occupy our time today, forms that require a real investment of time to be properly enjoyed, the novel remains a serious contender for first place, if you think of the commitment of time that a reader will put in to reading your book. When we think of how fragmented our entertainment time has become since 1959 and how many different media platforms compete for attention in our lives, from TV to smartphones to the internet, you might claim it's remarkable that the novel has survived as well as it has done. After all, the fundamental thing that a novel requires from its reader, above and beyond the ability to read, is a large investment of time. However, in 2011, there are other media types that require a similar investment of time. Computer games. For example, a game like Assassin's Creed, which is very popular with my 14-year-old son and his friends, if you look at Assassin's Creed, it's actually a very sophisticated political allegory set in a remarkably real simulacrum of Renaissance Italy, complete with appearances from Machiavelli. And it takes many hours to complete it. And the experience of completing it is not unlike that of reading a novel. It requires a similar level of concentration. As well as that, television drama has become increasingly novelistic in its approach to form and story. A long-form series like, for instance, The Sopranos, resembles nothing more than a complex work of fiction with its extraordinary reign of detail. Viewed in a DVD-boxed form, those commercial sponsors that McLennan was annoyed by no longer dilute or interrupt that kind of experience. However, again, despite this competition, the novel survives, and people continue to read. But truth be told, reading is changing. Publishing is changing. My publisher is here today, and we were just discussing the extraordinary changes that are happening at the moment. digitization is upon us. The hardcover or paperback book is now an analog outcome of an almost entirely digital process, from word processing programs writers use to write with to digital workflows in the publishing industry. This sort of intrigues me, the fact that this analog output in what in many ways is a completely digital industry now. A sort of note that within 6 weeks of The Mistress of Nothing coming out in hardcover in the U.S. this January, 25% of the total sales were e-books. Book retail, which is a sector that saw an enormous expansion in the decades after McLennan wrote his lecture, with first mall chain stores, followed by book superstores, followed by the big box stores selling heavily discounted books. Book retail is changing yet again, beyond that series of changes, as books and mortar bookshops find it harder to survive. Book marketing has also been altered beyond all recognition by television book clubs, literary festivals, book bloggers, and social media. There's been an explosion of reading and writing online, and the changes we're currently witnessing are as great as the change brought to society by the invention of the printing press itself. There's no doubt about that. And I remain optimistic about what this change can mean for the future of writing and reading, and I'm optimistic about the future of fiction as an art form. The book has a venerated position in our culture. As the photograph of the author in his or her booked line study demonstrates, the book is a status symbol of a very particular type, indicating erudition, learning, seriousness, taste, and authority. When aspiring authors say they want to be a writer, they often don't mean they want to do the really boring, hard graft bit of learning a craft in order to produce art, but rather that they want to be the person in that photograph, as rich as J.K. Rowling, as venerable as Hugh McLennan. A bitter laugh. However, while writers write for a variety of moments, of motives, most readers read fiction for two reasons. We read for two reasons. We read for good stories and for ideas. When readers worry about the future of the book, they frequently describe their fears in terms of worrying about a world without P-books. And P-books is what the publishing industry now calls print books, as opposed to e-books. P-books. They worry about a world where you can no longer read a book on the beach or in the bath. And it's true that the book itself, this particular type of book, is a lovely piece of technology. It's a portable, cheap, neat, and familiar content delivery system. That is what it is. It's a content delivery system. However, while there will always be people with a particular attachment to the physicality of the P-book itself, most people read for the pleasure, I'll say it again, afforded by a good story. As McLennan said, we read for characters, we read for entertainment, we read to be immersed in worlds other than our own. We read to learn, we read to acquire culture, to escape and to be moved and enlightened. We don't read in order to support the publishing industry. I'm sorry, Kim, but we don't. At the end of the day, the vast majority of readers do not read so they have another book to put on their shelf or to take back to the library. Digitization means that the book is evolving, and in the unlikely event that the P-book disappears completely, people will continue to want to be told stories. It's up to writers who are involved and invested in creating crafted text delivered through both the long-form prose narrative and newer forms to ensure that people keep wanting to read. I think that the long-heralded arrival of e-books and e-readers, enhanced e-books, etc., is really the least interesting aspect of fiction in the digital age. For the past decade, as well as writing novels and stories, I've been involved in creating works of digital fiction and electronic literature projects. To explain, my definition of the term digital fiction is a work of fiction whose material existence is dependent upon computers. In other words, the born digital. These are works that often combine media, including images, sounds, music, video, animation, games, to tell a story. Text remains a vital element to this hybrid form. Text is present on the screen, and in fact, in digital fiction, text remains the primary engine of storytelling. For me, this is most definitely a type of literature, a hybrid form, no doubt, but literature nonetheless. And I'm just going to, if the technology will work, which it doesn't always do, I'm just going to show a little bit. This is a project of mine. If you're interested, you can find it on my website. What exists here online is a precursor to a larger digital project that's going to be created over the next couple of years. I first came across the story. It's a story. I've been thinking about the story for about a decade. There's a supermarket in West London where, over the course of about a decade, bodies landed in this supermarket car park. Bodies fell out of the sky and landed in the car park. It transpired that it's on the flight path into Heathrow, and it's where planes lower their landing gear. And there was this myth in certain parts of the world that you could stow away on it into an airplane by climbing up the wheels, by getting onto the tarmac, climbing up the wheels and getting into the plane that way. But it's a myth. You can't do that. And if you try to stow away like that, you will almost always end up rather dead. But the story that I've been working on is about a young man, Pakistani man, who stows away on a plane and lands on a woman's car in this supermarket car park in West London. And because it's fiction, he survives. And the story is about their literal, very literal collision, the collision between East and West. But I'm just going to show you a few little, these are very brief fragments of the story so far. We couldn't get the sound to work on the system, so the microphone is pointed at the screen. So hopefully it's... Now, can you read that at the back, or shall I read it out loud? I told my family I was returning to Dubai. I spent a long time over my goodbyes. It's dark. My sister could tell that something was up, but I told no one my plans, not even her. I found it hard not to cry. At the airport, after passport control, I followed the instructions I had been given, for which I had paid. And found the unlocked door that led outside. I had less than 15 minutes after darkness fell to find the correct airplane. From the ground, the planes looked enormous, their lights blinking in the dusk. The air stank of petrol and tires. but I found it, and no one saw me, and I climbed up over the giant wheels and shimmied up the landing gear and folded myself onto the little shelf, which is exactly where Amer had said it would be. I'll just show it, the next one, which is equally short but very different in feeling. So this next one is Harriet, the woman whose car he lands on. This is from her perspective. Harriet driving. I have to go to the supermarket today, otherwise my family will starve. Well, not starve exactly. In the event of a war or a cataclysm of some kind, there's enough food in the house to last for how long? The pantry, the fridge, the storage jars, the cupboard full of breakfast cereal, the shelf of tins, the peas that have fallen out of their bag and are rolling around the bottom drawer of the freezer. The tahini that's older than my eldest child. It would be at least 1 month, maybe even two, before we have to eat those jars of red wine preserves my mother gave me several years ago. Except that isn't the point. The fact that there's already a ton of food in my house and I'm on the way to buy more is not the point. Well, there are plenty of wars and cataclysms happening elsewhere. As far as I can see, stuck as I am in the one-way system, Richmond is its usual placid, well-fed self this week. The family expect meals. They know that fairies do not replenish the cupboards in the night, but how, why, and when and where the food comes from is not something that interests them. It's not something that interests me either, but I'm a good wife. I'm a good mummy. So that's just a little snapshot of flight paths there. If you're interested, there are five of these stories that tell the beginning of this larger story that I'm going to be working on, which is about Harriet and Jacob and their meeting. So to finish, working in this particular emerging field has led me to think about both the nature of storytelling as well as the nature of reading. When you think about the history of humanity, you're thinking about a history of storytelling. Stories are a fundamental element of what makes us human. The stories we tell each other, as well as the stories we tell ourselves. We use words to conjure pictures, and that's one of the things that gives me the most pleasure as a reader, is the way that writers use words to conjure pictures. Sometimes we use pictures to conjure words. I always say that it's possible to see those extraordinary cave paintings hidden away in Chauvet in southern France as the world's first ever PowerPoint presentation. Here are the wild horses. There are the bison. Here's me with my spear by the firelight. In the context of our human urge to tell tall tales, you could argue that the book itself, in particular the novel, the fixed, unchanging long-form narrative, is simply one of many steps in a long evolutionary process, the evolution of storytelling. It's not a case of either or, P-book versus e-book, novel versus television, or even fiction versus non-fiction. As the 50 years since MacLennan wrote his lecture have proven, it's as well as, even and. I think that we're living in a golden age of reading and writing. Access to books as well as access to information is greater now than at any stage in our history. Around the globe, the new technologies are enabling literacy in new and innovative ways, and it's possible that for once we are indeed the right people in the right place at the right time. So there you go.
Thank you very much. I hope you have no regrets, because it's quite obvious that some of us who stuck it out need more education than others. And by the way, I had the pleasure of having Hugh MacLennan as a lecturer, and you didn't miss anything. He was a wonderful person, but you could hear the snoring in the background. I'm going to entertain some questions now, if you don't mind.
Yes, yeah.
From the audience after this very interesting talk. Who would like to start? Yes, please step up.
If I may. Despite your last statement, as I experienced it, it seemed to me that a constant theme in your talk was the notion of in-betweenness, whether person, place, thing, activity, art, etc. And so my question to you is, how does one establish one's bearings, both as an artist and as a consumer of art, in this in-between state?
Do you mean in particular current publishing in this in-between?
Well, just as the novel is evolving, so is society, our mores, the way our children react today is different than we did, etc., etc. So in this constantly changing world, where there are some things that are constant and other things that keep changing, how does one get one's bearings? How did you, for example, out of the young girl from the West in this strange city wanting to go to London, how did you manage to somehow establish some kind of bearing, identity for yourself?
Well, I think ignorance, it goes a long way, certainly when you're young. But no, I think it's a serious question, but I don't really have a proper answer for you, really. I think that we all have our own ways of navigating. I do agree that things are terribly complex and will continue to be. But for me, it's more really an issue of just trying to stay abreast of what's going on. Certainly when it comes to the changes in the digital realm, I think that writers and readers need to be thinking about these things as well. I think that there is a huge potential, especially for libraries at the moment, when it comes to access to books and to information. And you just have to keep your eye on the ball, really, I think.
What about all the distractions along the way?
Yeah, well, distractions, yes.
That's another story. Please, could you please step up to the microphone? Will you have one there?
My question is that with this talk of digital fiction, if we are now confining ourselves to text for story writing, I don't know if you've ever felt if you wanted to write an oral story. I saw that you were using images, but if the digital printing medium allows for the possibility that a story is told only orally.
Absolutely, because of the ease of audio recording now. In fact, I must confess that even though I am a dropout, I do teach in a university now, rather hypocritically. And one of my PhD students where I teach is a writer from the Gambia. And she is doing her PhD on the preservation of oral story traditions via digital means in the Gambia. The Gambia is one of those countries that has jumped from having very little access to media to having a huge amount of access to media through mobile phones, through cell phones, which are being used for banking and literacy training, et cetera, et cetera. So she's doing a project of recording stories using phones. Everybody has a phone in the Gambia to create a story archive. So, absolutely. That's not a field that I work in because I like text and I don't have a particularly good memory, et cetera, et cetera. So I like the written word for personal reasons. But
I just wanted to add to that because Kate is too humble to say what CBC just did, but Canada's National Broadcaster, the first audio-enhanced book they ever did was The Mistress of Nothing. And when Kate won the Governor General's Award in 2009, Kate and I started meeting with CBC, and they're so proud of themselves. And we released this enhanced audio plus video plus text in December, and it's already sold 1,000 copies in Canada. So that's
so pretty, there's
good, pretty good work.
There's my sponsor.
For the benefit of the ignorant, could you tell us what an enhanced audio is?
So what it is, it's the text of the book. You need a device that can cope with it, so you need an e-reader that has an audio component as well. So it's the text of the book, but there's also a recording of the book, so you can move seamlessly between listening to the book and reading it. So the book knows where you are. So, for instance, if you're in your car, you can listen to it, the book. But when you take your e-reader out of the car, you can then read the text. It knows where you left off. So.
The voice continues.
Yeah.
CBC did a bridged audio with an actress, Barbara Bryan.
Yeah. So
they put it in 15-minute segments on Sirius Radio and CBC over Christmas.
That's enough plugs, Kim.
Yes, please.
Let's see. Thank you very much. As our civilization is moving from P to E, has any responsible thought been given to its effect on readers, writers, publishers, bookstores, etc., etc.?
Absolutely. No, I think that's what people are really, really grappling with now, because none of us want to see reading or literature disappear at all. But the fact is that things are changing, and you cannot... There's no point in pretending it's not happening. There's no point in pretending that bookshops aren't closing, because they are. But at the same time, you know, it is now, because of the internet, it is now easier to find anything that you want to read, however obscure, than it ever has been. So, you know, it's really a mixed bag. It's really a mixed bag. But I think that, you know, in Canada, for instance, there are lots of organizations working on behalf of readers and writers and the preservation of literature as a form. So, you know, but things are changing, absolutely. Let's look again at that in 50 years.
Over here, please.
Could you tell us a little bit more about how you actually concretely put together your flight pass? Who did the filming? What does it involve? To what extent you have to pare down the written word? How do you weigh how much writing versus how much visual and the pacing, et cetera?
Yeah, it's extremely different than writing a novel. And I did spend about a decade where I was writing for film and television. So I spent quite a lot of time thinking about how to tell a story without using great chunks of text. This project plus the project that was mentioned earlier, Inanimate Alice, I worked on with my collaborators called Chris Joseph, and it's created using a technology called Flash. We collect all the photographs and make all the videos. I write scripts that structure the story, because as with a film, one of the most important writing tasks with a piece of digital media is story structure, so that you can figure out what part of the story can be carried by image and sound and music, and what parts of the story need to be conveyed in text. So it's a kind of complicated collaborative process. I certainly don't have the technical skills necessary to be able to create work like this myself, but at the same time, it's just two of us. It's not like you need a huge technical team or anything like that.
Yes, please.
I'm wondering where you situate the graphic novel in all this.
Well, clearly there's a, yeah, the graphic novel is a kind of, not precursor because it's obviously still a common form, but there are synergies definitely between the two forms. I think what I showed you today is a real hybrid because it's animation and video as well as kind of the frame by frame graphic novel story. So, yeah, I mean one of the things that's most interests me about this type of work, which is not very visible in what I showed you today, is interactivity. I had a very interesting experience with Inanimate Alice, the other project that I mentioned, which is extremely popular in schools around the world. And about a year and a half ago, at the moment there are 4 episodes online of Inanimate Alice, and a year and a half ago I came across online some episode 5s, a collection of episode 5s. And so I, you know, followed the links. And what I realized was that a teacher somewhere in the U.S. had been using Inanimate Alice in her class to work with students that she termed as hard to reach, teenagers. And they used the stories in the classroom, and then she'd allowed them to create their own versions of what would happen next. They created their stories using PowerPoint, because with PowerPoint you can add music and sound, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, that was a very meaningful type of interactivity. It was a very meaningful sort of writer-reader interaction, the fact that these kids were making their own episode 5s. And since then, there's been a whole sort of, there's lots of episode 5s that have sprung up. And that for me, that was a big eye-opener really for me as a writer interested in the potential for this kind of thing online.
The back, please.
Okay, I guess my question sort of goes on to twofold. First of all, what's going to happen to all the bookstores as we go from PDE? Because we're losing a culture that is very quite significant. Like, for example, in Montreal, we've lost about, to my knowledge anyways, a good 5 secondhand bookstores within a few mile radius, and each one was quite vibrant at its time. So what's going to happen to that culture? And also, too, what's going to happen when it comes to jobs as well? Like, are there still going to be jobs in the print media? What type of jobs are going to be available? Because when you go to a bookstore, you know, there's this one-on-one interaction that can happen. While if everything's going online, you don't have the same ability to browse, and there's just a whole culture which I'm sure everyone is familiar with.
Absolutely, yeah, and I think that there are electronic equivalents, but there's nothing like going into a really good bookshop and being sold a book by a bookseller who really knows what they're doing. That is really, you know, that is, as yet, I've never seen that replicated online or remotely, really. So I'm not a futurologist, sadly. I have no idea what's going to happen to that aspect of our culture. But you're absolutely right that that is changing very quickly, and the bookshop, the bricks and mortar bookshops are going quickly. In the UK, they're going very quickly as well. In the UK, though, in the last year, there's been an interesting resurgence of strength in the independent sector. It seems to be the big chains that are falling down rather rapidly. But in the independent bookselling sector, there does seem to be fresh signs of life. But those booksellers really have to know what they're doing in order to be able to survive. So, you know, who knows? I mean, I had a conversation the other day in Toronto, thanks to my sister who's sitting at the back, with a woman called Maureen Cavan who runs Access Copyright Canada. And we were talking about, you know, what does it all mean? What does it mean for libraries? Who's going to hold the keys, really, to the content? Who's going to own these stories that we all love as readers? And I do think it's a terrifically, terrifically complex subject, but I also think that it's one that we need to really deeply engage with as readers and writers. If you love your local bookstore, then buy your books there. Don't buy them from Amazon. You know, there's simple things like that, but, you know, it is a very complicated situation.
I have the lady at the back there in the green.
That's you.
Hi. I was actually moved to ask you a question since you mentioned the UK and the bookstores. I'm from the UK, and I think it's not just in the last year or so. There was a resurgence in a very small town that you've probably never heard of called Atherstone, which is where my parents live, where they actually declared it a book town. It's an old market town. It used to be a hatting town. And they set up like 3 or 4 secondhand bookstores, and it became part of a heritage culture. And I'm intrigued by the idea that you use these digital medias to tell what seem very contemporary stories. And then there's the book form of The Mistress of Nothing, which is obviously a kind of neo-Victorian kind of return to the Victorian era. And so I'm particularly interested in the hybrid audio-enhanced version that you did of that, that brought those two together. And I'm wondering if you feel like there's different mediums for historical fiction versus contemporary fiction.
No, I don't actually, because I think that at the end of the day, what you want is the story and the author's voice, and how it's delivered is immaterial. I really do believe that. It might take you a while to get accustomed to reading electronically, but once you're accustomed to it, there is no difference if what you want is the story, the quality of the writing, and the author's voice. There's no difference. If you're a book fetishist, like most of us are, and you like the smell of books and the feel of the pages, etc., then you will miss that. But I do, you know, I think that, you know, when you read, there is that strange sort of, I think of it as a kind of third space. There's the book, there's the text, there's the writer, the reader, and then there's this world in between, that this connection that you make that exists in your head. And I don't think that the words have to be in a book for that to happen.
We'll take a couple more questions.
Oh, I just had the experience of sending an article out to a periodical, and it was accepted, but I was asked to also send a CD. Well, I want you to know that was harder than writing my article. No, seriously. And, you know, for many writers, we're computer nerds. You know, I engaged the help of my whole family on that, and I still haven't heard whether at the other end whether they received my DVD. It's a tall order for many of us writers who are technologically ignorant and, you know.
It's for me one of the current sort of puzzles or gaps in what's going on is the fact that I don't think that there's many creative writing programs around the world that are grappling with this sufficiently, really. I think a lot of creative writing, certainly graduate programs, are almost sort of 19th century in approach to their approach to the text, and that young writers, new writers, people who are on these programs need to have this, you know, need to be thinking about these issues, because it's not just around the corner, it's here. It's absolutely here now.
It's terrifying.
One more question.
I think this Flight Paths is marvelous. It's very exciting. What I'm wondering about, could you comment on the role of the reader? Will we be more passive? I've always felt that we meet you halfway in the book. What happens when pictures give you a lot of the information? There's text, etc. Can you comment on that, please?
Yeah, no, I'm not interested in it. For me, it is a hybrid form, and it does use other media to help tell the story, but it's not passive in the way that television is. One of the things that I've done with all this type of work that I've done is I've never used images or photographs or anything like that to depict the characters, because for me, that is part of what makes it more akin to text on the page, is that you see it in your head. You're not given too much information by what's on the screen. Hopefully the additional media enhances the story, as opposed to overly directing the story, overly directing your imagination. And for me, that it's a kind of careful balance. However, having said that, I'm not at all advocating that that's the way things have to be. I still think that, you know, we're going to be reading text like this for a very long time. So it's not either or. It's a as well as. Yes. Did that answer your question?
Thank you very much. It's really wonderful to have you back at McGill. And I will now let Paul give you your grades.
Thank you, Nick.
Oh, my God.
It's all planned, you know. Now everyone has to go out and write a test. The questions that you've raised, the kind of art that you've produced, your talk, which was about the creative process, but also about how literature is able to mobilize a certain kind of social creativity through narrative, seems to me quite rightly to be of a piece with the kinds of discussions that are going on among the students and faculty at McGill about mediation, digitization, and literature. So welcome home to McGill. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm just instructed to tell you that there is a reception over there, and there are books for sale, and I believe our guest will be willing to sign books for you. Thank you.